just a couple of more questions from me. First question is this. For large attachments where there are multiple, or many rather, deemed permits, such as Manahita Care, how do you see this working out, assuming that the regime is WAP regime, the controlled activity or RDA activity applies? Is that going to be difficult or easy to do with as many, many deemed permits? So that's what we're given to understand.
Sally Dicey, there are many deemed permits on those catchments, but I'm not sure how many of those actually linked through priorities.
Mm-hmm.
So say if there's 200 in the Manahiri Care, there are subgroups of linked priorities, is my understanding. So sometimes you might have a trib where there are just two that are interlinked.
Yeah.
I haven't seen a permit with more than, I don't know, maybe 10 priorities interlinked on it. That's off the top of my head, but I can't recall.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you're thinking like the main stem of a river, say the Manahita Care or the Tairi or whatever, you're not thinking that there's going to be hundreds of these interlinked permits.
No, not at all.
So for something like the main stem of the Manahita Care, how many linked deemed permits with rights or priorities would there be? Do you know roughly?
Sally Dicey, sorry, off the top of my head, I think there are about four to six within the main stem itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And sticking with the main stem of the Manahita Care, are there also resource consents to take and use water? So you've got the old deem permits which are trundling along, but these are resource consents which are granted under the Act.
Sally Dicey, the key, to my knowledge, all of the key main stem takes from the Manahiri Care are still authorised by deemed permits.
Mm-hmm.
There may be some outliers, some small privately held permits, and I'm not sure whether they were ever interlinked through priorities or not, so I'm not clear on those resource consents.
So this is where we're really interested in this questioning of interlinking, if at all, between resource consents granted for water permits in the ordinary way under the Act and deemed permits for the same water body. Can you comment on how this works in with something like that? So perhaps the scenario I would put to you is that I am the downstream permit holder on a deemed permit and there's an upstream RMA consent. How does this all work in together, the RMAs and the deemed permits?
So, Sally Dicey, in a situation like that, the resource consent has either been granted not, or as a in the first instance, as a water permit under the RMA and was never subject to a deemed permit priority, or it's a replacement of a deemed permit, which may or may not have had an interlinking priority, in which case, at its renewal, the priority would have fallen away, and in those circumstances, nothing would have replaced it. There may be some informal kind of system between the parties, the two permit holders. So to my mind, it really only applies to those interlinking remaining deemed permits with priority where most of them are still remaining as deemed permits. And in the catchments I've worked to date, that has been a driver for them to act collectively in replacing their permits. And so I think what we've seen with some that haven't yet come in is that they've held off and were going to come in as a group. So in many of those cases where there are significant interlinkings of those priorities, mostly there won't be that many permits that would have been replaced.
RMA permits that effectively might be taking water, and then somebody with a a deed, on the priority system,
yeah,
effectively wants to tell somebody below, well, it would have to be above somebody with an RNA permit, wouldn't it,
mm-hmm,
to do something because they've got insufficient water. The cause of the insufficient water might not be the deemed permit. It may be the RMA permit, which there's no ability to tell the RMA permit to turn off. So what would happen in those situations? How many of them are there, and what would it mean in terms of the person's ability to require that the priority arrangement be adhered to?
Sally Dicey, so there are situations like that where you've had some people who have replaced already, and that is basically just the new status quo, as much as there is a status quo, in terms of some of those priorities may have fallen by the wayside, and they either just don't get called or they can't be adhered to. Often, I would imagine that in some cases there may be an informal arrangement or often the property itself and the infrastructure on that property will reflect if it has been something that has been part and parcel of the regime on that tributary, then infrastructure may reflect that. The way the farm may have been developed will reflect that, and so the setup of the takes may reflect that. But basically there will be no ability for a deemed permit holder to call priority on someone, my understanding, who's now holding an RMA consent.
Would it be fair to say that for those permits which have been reconsented now under the RMA, that if that took place under the operative plan, then that policy that Mr. Page referred us to, 5.4.3, was applied and considered at the time that the consent was decided. In other words, that there was that the consent authority, in deciding to grant that permit, did have regard to existing, I haven't got the words in front of me, but the other existing lawful users, including those persons who had deemed permits and with rights of priority. In other words, that policy was brought into account together with the assessment matters. Mr. De Pulsmaker.
Yes, Tom De Pulsmaker. I've never worked in the consent space, but what I think would have or likely to happen is that consents officers would consider that policy, but they wouldn't actually bring down the priorities on the resource.
No, understood. I just need to know that it was considered, and then how might that be reflected in consent conditions, if at all?
Probably, if it was at all considered, it would have been through the rates of takes or the volumes allocated, making sure that any downstream users would still end up with sufficient water. Yes.
Mr. Brass.
Mary Brass would also note, in my experience, such consents, because they've gone through the operative plan process, have been required as part of that to assess in-stream ecology, other users, and probably particularly residual flows, sometimes minimum flows are applied. But I think there is a tension there within the operative plan, and that you've got that policy which says to consider existing users, but you also have the policy which sets the allocation for that water body as all of the existing takes added up. So in my experience, it hasn't often been that new consents have been conditioned in a way that sort of winds that back. So they would normally still have the ability to take without being subject to priorities, in my experience.
Because the allocation is the sum of all takes.
Yep, so therefore the water is technically available, get your consent granted.
All right. Ms. King, what about you? What's your experience?
Alexandra King, yes, I would have to agree with Mr. Brass in terms of that allocation being available, and then you may take in a party as an affected party and you might get written approval from that party, or residual flows and flow sharing regimes also might be incorporated into consent.
Right. Okay, and Mr. De Palsmaker.
Thank you, Mr. Tom DePalsmaker. Just one thing I want to add to that is we also have a policy in the plan, policy 642A, which basically works a little bit like the schedule. So when you have fully allocated catchments, you come in for a consent, you only allocate based on historic use, except that the methodology is not spelled out. So that, again, is a mechanism to make sure that the priority is probably a bad word, but that the effect of the priority is translated into the allocated volumes, and so you're not going to encroach on the allocation or water use of downstream users.
Mm. Okay. Mr. Ensor, did you have anything to add?
No, I didn't. Thanks.
Right. All right, so we're to understand that if there are any resource management consents out there, and we understand there are resource management consents out there, and that issues as to the allocation for those consents and the interaction of the using of that allocation have all, relative to deemed permits have been taken into account on consenting, and that's not a matter that we need to turn our minds to. Would that be fair? Everybody's nodding? Okay, all right.
Talking about the priorities that there are on the deed permits also being considered as part of that or not? Because I wasn't clear from your answers, and perhaps Ms. King could start, because the last time you appeared in front of us, Ms. King, I think you said, well, what I took out of it, and this may be quite wrong, was that priorities wasn't something that you concerned yourself with.
No, it isn't currently something we concern ourselves with.
I thought Mr. De Palsmaker's answer to reference to policy 4.2A, I think you said just then, was that the was to the effect that the allocation under the deemed permit was brought into account.
Yes.
Yep. And so perhaps if maybe you respond to the Commissioner's concerns.
Isn't that a different point?
It's a different point, but and again, I'm not a consents officer, so I cannot say whether priorities have deliberately been considered, but the effect of a priority would have been is visible, so to speak, on the water taking graph. It would have ramifications in terms of the volumes or the quantities of water that are being taken under the consent or the permit that is proposed to be replaced. So when it comes to renewal, policy 642A will ensure that the effect is captured in the allocations allocated under the new consent. Does that make sense?
So are we back to the trace point then? So that the use that, all these people that may have priority rights,
yeah,
and may or may not have exercised them, when the consents people are looking, they're going back to the trace to see what was actually being used at various times, various conditions.
I'm not sure if they will...
hydrological conditions, et cetera.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they will actively look at that. I think I'll let Ms. King speak.
Alexandra King. So no, we don't actively look at what priorities were being exercised and how they were being used, but we do look at things like downstream users and what flow they were taking. And that helps us under 642A to allocate the water back to them, which, if priorities were being used, would help us make that determination. But we don't specifically look to see whether the priorities were being exercised.
Right, so you're looking at the records of what they have been taking.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Mr. Leslie.
Sean Leslie speaking, just in addition to what Alex was saying, that's part of where the analysis that I perform on water use patterns comes into it, is if there are any discernible patterns in the work that I do, I will relay that to the consents team so that they can take that into account.
But you don't go looking to find out whether that was as a result of people's priorities. You just take it as you see it in terms of the record.
Yes.
Thank you.
Sally Dicey, just picking up on what Mr. De Pelsmaker was saying about looking at the allocation, and I think that does take you so far in understanding people's access, including potentially to some extent priorities and how they may have been called on you or you may have called them, but it only goes so far because it doesn't necessarily reflect the timing. So it's the total amount, or the maximum rate, but not the timing at which you've accessed the water, which can be the critical component of priorities. So when flows are low, you get to call priority and access flows. I think it has been, in my experience, it has been quite a hands-off approach by the council, and that possibly reflects the history of priorities in terms of leaving it to priority right holders to deal with amongst themselves. And that's almost reflected in the reconsenting. And we've actually, as their consultants, worked with them to understand if the priorities are important to them, and if they are, then how does the effect of them get recognised going forward? And again, as I said, that's often been at a catchment scale or sub-catchment-based scale, and if they are important within that catchment, people have come together, worked together, and through that full assessment have developed something else together.
All right. Anybody else like to answer? Mr. Brass?
Just Murray Brass. For completeness, note that there is an element of a priority system remains in the sense that most resource consents will be subject to a minimum flow or a residual flow. Mm. They have to switch off at that point. Deemed permits don't, so they have the ability to continue. So while they can't call priority on resource consents, they do get to keep taking water after resource consents have had to switch off under low flow circumstances.
Hmm. Tom De Pelsmaker, I acknowledge that, but the deemed permit catchments, if I can call them that, catchments that are dominated by deemed permits, they might have minimum flows on them, but they are not effective yet. So the effects of those minimum flows wouldn't have kicked in yet. So they would all be deemed permits, as well as consents, would not be held to any minimum flows in those catchments. And that's because another policy in the plan that basically says they'll only kick in it in 2021 on the expiry of deemed permits, unless all the consent holders in that catchment commit to implementing that minimum flow earlier, which I don't think has happened.
No. For the purpose of this discussion, the deemed permit catchments, which catchments in Schedule 2A? So Manahirikia presumably is one.
Manahirikia, Tairi, Luggett, Kakanui? I think there's a deemed permit on the Kakanui.
Kakanui?
Yeah. Mm. But there's, I think, one deemed permit still. Lindis, which is not yet, but soon to be in the schedule, hopefully. Have I forgotten any?
Arrow
is not yet in the schedule.
Not in the schedule. And what about Cardrona?
Not yet in the schedule.
Okay. All right. Okie dokie. So penultimate question. This is one I asked the lawyers, but they obviously didn't like it, so I can ask you instead, which is, if there's a vires issue, you know, a legal issue that I have to deal with, or we have to consider generally with what you've proposed, because what you're proposing is a condition that gives the dominant consent holder the right to tell somebody to turn off. I said, or I asked the lawyers, could the vares issue, if there is one, be overcome by requiring, and this could actually be now part of policy, requiring the applicant to obtain neighbour's approval, and the neighbour's approval to be given for the application on the terms sought. So that's really important. It's for that application on the terms sought. So it's not conditional to anything. What do you think? If there's a vares issue there, and I think there is potentially, could that overcome that? That's, I guess, in part a legal question, in part a planning question. So the policy is, you know, the policy is whatever the policy is, but it has that as a component. And the application, and an application has been lodged together with the approvals, or affected party approvals.
So, Sally Dicey, just to understand, just to make sure I've understood you correctly, the workaround could be, if there is a virus issue, the workaround that you're suggesting is, so two permit holders, the dominant subservient, the dominant has to obtain the subservient
approval for the application on the terms.
On the terms.
Yep.
So the condition be applied against the subservient.
But yep. The subservient's actually agreed to it.
Yes.
Yep.
I had contemplated something like that, so almost a whether it's a kind of a written, a simple written approval.
Yes.
As part of their application. I guess the potential stumbling block is that the subservient says, no, I don't like the idea of you carrying on your priority, and then almost pulling all of that group of priority holders down the non-complying pathway.
There's no doubt you could get a rogue applicant, but is the answer to that, and this is the second part of the question, for a subservient permit holder, that they too are obliged to get the approval of the dominant together with any servient, so that everybody is being held to obtaining approvals for applications on the terms sought. And no one's going rogue, if you like.
And perhaps, yes, Sally Dicey again, and perhaps it's the 80-20 rule again, it might even be a 90-10 rule. And we did talk about those kind of things quite a lot at the conference thing. I think that could be effective, and I think it's actually very close to the I will agree to this condition, but it's just taking a step further and getting the other priority holders within your subset to also make
agreed.
That clear that they've agreed. Yep.
So it's
only a small step further.
Yeah. Mr. Ensor, are you happy with that?
Tim Ensor, on the face of it, that would seem like an option. It might also be an opportunity to alleviate some of the concerns raised by RSC technical folk in terms of contact details and all those sorts of things that would potentially provide a vehicle.
we've got to talk about that with Ms. King. And so I saw it either coming in the policy or coming in the entry conditions for the RDA or for the control. Would you want to comment on that? It has to have some real force behind it.
I initially jumped to mind as being an entry.
An entry condition.
An entry
period.
Condition. Yep. The policy can be more general about the priority issue.
Thank you. Mr. De Polsmaker.
I agree with what Ms. Dicey and Mr. Ensor have said. I'm just kind of let it sink in.
You'll come back to you, Mr. Brass.
Murray Brass. I agree that I think it could be made to work, but I would probably still have a preference if the use of, essentially the applicant volunteers that condition as part of their application, be it through a tick box or whatever, if that can be constructed in a way that it deals with the vires issue, I think that would be simpler.
Yeah, just to deal with the vires issue.
Yeah.
my gut is that there's a virase issue. And so what are you saying there? So I would assume that the entry condition, if it's an entry condition, the entry condition is then the application. The applicant wouldn't be volunteering this as a condition. The applicant would be obtaining neighbour's approval to the application on the terms sought. And that would be, and it would be, I'm suggesting that it's not just the dominant obtaining neighbour's approval from the subservient, but if you're also subservient and you're going back upstream, to the dominant or downstream to the dominant, and or whichever direction it goes, and looking at other subservients. That's what I'm suggesting, so that everybody in that little water body or long water body is caught. Thoughts? You want to think about that further? Well, how did you see it?
My concern is that is adding a moderate amount of complexity to the process. So if that was required to deal with the virase issue,
might be also required to deal with the rogue app, the rogue subservient permit holder.
Yeah, I consider that rogue situation could be dealt with under the plan and enforcement proceedings as per normal.
No, this is where your neighbour says, well, I'm not going to give neighbour's approval for you to turn off my water. I am not.
That only arises if that neighbour's approval is required. If the consent, as the plan is currently structured, doesn't require that neighbour's approval, then that rogue issue doesn't become an issue.
But is that right, though? Because isn't the reason to bring this issue up in raising this issue... it is because there is a potential for the flow regime to change and access to water to change, hence people's hitherto reliability of supply changes. So how can you say that people would not be affected by that? I mean, on that understanding, people might rightly say at the 1st of October, there will be significant effects if there's not a policy response.
Yes, and sorry, I certainly was not intending to say that it wouldn't be an effect on parties. My thinking is more that in terms of dealing with the virase issue, if the virase issue can be done by constructing the application in a way where the applicant has volunteered that condition... without requiring a written approval process, then that would be a simpler way of addressing it. I have to defer to the lawyers in that if I'm agreeing to that condition as part of any controlled activity as opposed to a non-complying, whether that counts as having volunteered the condition sufficiently to address the virase issue, I'm not sure.
Okay. All right.
But if that was possible, that would be my preferred approach.
To do what I've suggested, or to not do anything and just deal with it via the application form?
Deal with it via the application.
All right.
For the sake of simplicity.
Ms. King, have you got any comments?
Alexander King. Yeah, I do agree with Mr. Brass in terms of whether it's whether there is the ability to word the application in a way that the applicant would not only propose to have the conditions on their own consent, but any conditions that would mean that someone had dominance over their consent could also be applied. And I wonder if that's a way around that issue. I probably couldn't comment on how easy it might be for an applicant to get written approval from someone prior. If that makes sense.
Mm.
And I agree with Mr. Ensor in terms of it being a entry condition rather than a
policy.
Mm.
But you don't think an entry condition is necessarily required? Is that what you're saying?
I think if it was in the application form where they had proposed it, but my only concern with that is if it's not an entry condition, then and they don't tick the box,
yeah,
you get yourself into a bit of a tricky situation.
So then
it would be
on balance an entry condition.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Anybody else want to comment?
Sally Dicey, I do agree with Mr. Brass, and perhaps it's simply that as a subservient deemed priority holder, by ticking the box saying you will agree to the condition, then you're inherently giving your written approval for somebody else to call priority over you. So perhaps that actually...
So you're thinking this more applies to anybody who's in that category of being subservient?
Well, it's less of an issue for the dominant permanent holder, because they're the one that'll be giving the instruction,
yeah.
So they're not losing out. So it's really about the subservient priority holders being, you know, told to give up their access by another permanent holder to water. But by ticking the condition saying, yep, I agree to this condition, then they're effectively giving their written approval for that dominant person to call priority over them. And that's what the condition is doing, is allowing someone to do that over them.
As written or to be tweaked?
As written, with maybe some of the tweaks suggested.
All right. Mr. De Palsmaker.
Yeah, I agree with Ms. Dicey. It's good to have the condition in the application and written approval on the terms of that application means that they agree to that condition.
Mm-hmm.
It also avoids the issue that written approval is being given, but it results in a flow-sharing mechanism that is agreed by everyone, but is different from the priority system.
So if they don't tick the box,
then
what?
I'm not familiar with the mechanics of consenting enough.
Okay. Non-compliant?
Non-compliant, yeah.
All right. Think about that.
If it's in the entry condition, it would be yes, yeah.
So, but I think on balance you're not suggesting any amendment to the entry condition, or are you?
Not substantial.
No, on this specific issue.
No.
No, okay, got it. All right, and then the last question was, it seemed to me that anybody who is wanting to seek a replacement consent, particularly for those consents expiring on the 1st of October, will have got their application in. If you wish to take advantage of either the controlled route or the RDA route, you're going to have to amend those applications substantially. And everybody's agreeing to that? Yeah. So we can't assume that... one of the issues raised by you, Ms. King, is what if you've got an applicant that's turned up and, people who are the beneficiaries of a deemed permit who are wanting to slice and dice the deemed permit, you know, amongst the shareholders of a race, which I think is an example that you might have given us, then what are you meant to do with that? And the answer is, I don't think this process contemplates those applications. They might have to, if they want their water for the next 6 years under a controlled activity rule, they're going to have to amend that application and bring it back in line with the original permit. Would that be fair?
Simon Wilson, I was just going to say, there may still be the issue, though, with one of the downstream permits is looking to slice and dice. So would you then require them to amend their application as well?
I would have thought the answer to that is if everybody wants to take advantage of this, then yes, is my thought. I can't see how you can do it otherwise. Ms. Dicey.
Sally Dicey. I don't think there's going to be a lot of slicing and dicing of anything under PC7. I think my understanding is that everything will just go on hold, and there will be a substantial reconfiguration of applications and basically going through the application form to realign the applications with the control activity or the RDA.
So this is really important. Does anyone see it any differently from Ms. Dicey?
Alexandra King. It's kind of tricky to comment on what applicants are going to potentially do.
Yeah.
I am aware that a few applicants have been in the system for a really long time, and I don't know how open they would be to amending their application that significantly, but again, I can't really comment on what applicants might or may not do. I am aware that where applicants have applied separately from shareholders, like you mentioned earlier, it is sometimes based on the fact that those relationships aren't the best. And so I don't know whether this will hinder that or create a pathway that they actually do end up applying together. It's quite hard to say how it will go.
Sally Dicey, I'd just add to that, the applicants that I'm have been working with, I think they feel that if PC7 becomes operative in the form that it currently is, with a non-complying activity pathway basically a closed door to them, that they feel like they have no choice but to significantly alter their applications.
Tim Ensor, just thinking a little bit about the entry condition versus just a tick box, I guess and I would have to give this more thought probably, but having an entry condition in a way allows for some flexibility in the form that comes in, and whether there was a slicing and dicing, then you might be able to achieve the objective without ticking the box. You'd have a very similar condition, for example.
So what's your scenario there, sorry?
I'm thinking if there was a number of shareholders on a race, for example, and their permits were coming in separately. There might be an opportunity for something slightly bespoke if the written approval was provided, rather than just relying on a standard tick box. Early thoughts, obviously.
But that's a good thought, though. Because one of the things that worried me about something that you said, Ms. King, was, well, folk might have been doing things their own way or going their own way for the last 30 years under deemed permits, perhaps changing the point of take, perhaps that was one of the things I know you did actually mention, changing the point of take. They may well be there were other things that you mentioned as well, which the region may not be across. And so you get these applications in for the first time, and it's like, And again, part of the answer to that is under the controlled and RDA, well, people might have to be substantially amending. They may have to be doing 136 applications. I don't know. But we can talk about that later. So those are my questions anyway. Commissioner, have you got any questions?
Well, I just wondered about transfers. How are transfers dealt with in terms of this new rule framework?
Tom de Postmarker. It did, actually, I started thinking about it after reading Ms. King's evidence. and maybe that's a little bit too late. I admit that. Ms. King basically set out two scenarios, or a mixture of two scenarios, whereby you have transfers of shareholdership, if I can call it that, which makes the process more complicated, more complex, but it doesn't seem insurmountable in terms of you might still be able to achieve the outcome that you look for. The other one is the transfer of point of take.
Yes.
But I take Ms. Dicey's comment. A lot of people, a transfer of point of take will often be accompanied by an investment in new intake infrastructure and irrigation infrastructure. The six-year permit is probably going to be discouraging that. However, I'll be honest, I did think over the weekend, like, does there need to be in the controlled activity rule a mechanism basically addresses that risk that there still is going to be a transfer of a point of take. Where that is coupled to a priority, you might have totally different outcomes.
And so what are you suggesting then? How might you deal with that problem? Might it be an RD sort of thing? Or?
It might be, and it might be that in the control, in the controlled activity rule that you put in it. I'm just thinking out of the top of my head now, that there, that you try to consolidate the current point of take within the controlled activity, and if you don't meet that, go to an RD. But that is, like I said, just out of the top of my head now.
So would there be quite a number of examples of these points of take that have never been regularised on the deemed permits? Would there? Would there be quite a number of deemed permits where the point of take actually differs from what was authorised? A lot of people might have bothered to fix it up on the basis that, well, hey, we've got to do something about this sometime in 30 years or whatever, anyway.
I recall some of the evidence that was suggested as well, that the point of take is often not, I think it was the evidence of Mr. Cummings, that the point of take is often not properly aligned with what is on the consent or on the permit itself. That is to be addressed, I guess, through a regular auditing of those permits.
So, sorry, I'm a little lost as to what you think. I mean, if this is an issue, how might it be dealt with?
I don't know how big the issue is. And again, it comes down to risk management, I guess. I don't know how, like I said, I don't know how many people are intending to change the point of take. Is it worthwhile putting something in the controlled activity or in the rule framework to address that? It depends how big the risk is. Because by doing that, you might actually constrain people as well, or disincentivize that pathway.
So if you're forced down the non-complying route, which you could be, what's it likely to mean on the non-complying activity route if things are pretty neutral all round in terms of effects, for example?
Well, under the non-complying activity rule, you could consider the effects of that change of the point of take and what it means for the environment.
I was just thinking if you wanted to follow all the other entry things, but say, well, we can't deal with this one, but actually, really, it's pretty neutral in terms of the other control activity sort of things that you worry about and the effects, then you'd presumably get your non-complying activity relatively simply, would you?
No.
No? A risk factor?
I guess my concern was more what Mr. Cummings might have been talking about, that you haven't done an audit, not you personally, but ORC has not audited these takes, and that there have been changes happening over the last 30 years, which should, applicant permit holders should have sought permission from the regional council to amend permits, like amending the point of take or transferring to another person or whatever, Mr. Cummings talks about. And so your database is a bit out of date. But then whose problem is that? It's ORC's problem. It's got a duty to.
It is. And I think in the last couple of years as well, we have done, again, Mr. Cummings later on might be better placed to comment on that. But we've gone through catchments, I believe, 2 years ago. We did the entire Mana Harakia to audit water metering data. And I think the same happened with the Kadrona not so long ago. So that has been done, but there are still, I believe, a number of irregularities.
Right.
So,
It's, the question is whether those irregularities trip up this plan change.
Well, yeah, and I don't think that the discrepancy between where the point of take is on the consent and where the point of take in reality is not that big that it will trip up the plan change.
Mm.
What could trip up the mechanism that we're trying to put in place is if people actively seek to change the point of take.
So does that mean then that you're thinking that it mightn't be a desirable thing then to have an easier pathway for an alternative point of take? On balance, is that what you've arrived?
An easier pathway, yes, but not such that it encourages them also. You know, if you make it, if you simply allow for it under the controlled activity rule, that could actually hinder you to achieve your outcomes, which is to keep that flow regime going.
Right, so that's the control that something like RG... Maybe.
If you can take that effect, the effect of that, into consideration, then the RDA could be a possible way to address that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Enzo, I think you wanted to say something.
Yeah, Timmy, so I was just wanting to maybe comment on the irregularities between the point of take on paper and on the ground. And I suppose it's probably another risk-based discussion as to how, you know, if what we're trying to do here is reflect what's been happening rather than what's been on paper, then maybe the risk is a little more acceptable.
Right.
Because if it's been wrong for 30 years, then that's what the environment is.
Yeah, understood. Mr. Leslie.
At the risk of Sean Leslie speaking, at the risk of being corrected by Mr. Cummings tomorrow, my experience is that the majority of the discrepancies between what the paper says, where the point of take is, and where it actually is, down to the fact that the deemed permits that have been reissued or recorded by the Regional Council record the location spatially as a grid reference, which is saying it's somewhere in this 100 metre by 100 metre square, which creates difficulties when you're trying to when you're trying to talk about a specific point, and you know, you might even have multiple waterways in the same grid reference.
Okay. Simon Wilson, I was just going to add that where metering is in place, there is a process to capture the location of that meter as well. Not saying that means there's not anomalies out there or differences between that and the paper, but we do have information on where the abstraction point is supposed to be and a process for exemptions where the abstraction, where the metering is different from the abstraction point.
All right. You got any more questions,
Commissioner? I'll just have one last one, because I didn't feel that I got a full answer to my earlier question, which was the position where you might have an RMA permit that's got conditions and things on it, and then down below that you've got someone with a priority one and they want to call time on somebody higher up because they're not getting enough water. And it may be the reason they're not getting enough water is because the RMA permit is able to take it all. So I guess my question is then, well, how is it reasonable to call time on somebody higher up in terms of your insufficient water lowered down when actually it's an RMA permit that's causing that problem for you?
Sally Dicey, so just to understand, make sure I've understood you correctly, priority two, upstream, RMA permit in between, in the middle, and then priority one, downstream.
Yeah.
So that might well be a situation in reality. The other example, equally the same, or different but equally the same effect, is priority two up above, priority one down below, with a drying reach in between, or a drying reach somewhere in between the two. Yeah. Those are the instances, and there are many of them, where the priorities probably didn't get called and didn't get utilised. So they've sat there. You know, it may have got called at some time in the distant past, but when the RMA permit came on stream, then maybe the priority just went by the wayside. Equally, with the drying reach, maybe there was no point in calling because the water still won't turn up at the higher order priorities point of take. So there are lots of instances where priorities exist, but for whatever reason, they practically don't have effect.
But what's to stop the person calling time on it?
Historically?
No, I'm not worried about historically. I'm looking at what might happen under a future regime.
So I guess the two link in my mind. Historically, there's been nothing to stop them. In the future, there'll be nothing to stop them, besides the social cohesion of rural communities, really. And again, I think it would be a very unusual situation with potentially significant social ramifications in some of these small communities.
Okay, thank you.
Simon Wilson, I was just going to add, I think that's a very good question, and it's one of the problems that I have with carrying the priority system forward. And I think there's a sort of next level of that where you may have three in a row, and the one in the middle previously might have been a deemed permit that was in the priority scheme and has now turned into an RMA permit and dropped off, which puts more pressure on the priority at the top, because the person at the bottom used to be able to call priority over two permits and now only has one they can exercise it over.
Thank you.
Okay, I apologise. I didn't actually read properly your servient right of priority consent holder condition, which I see why you're saying on receipt, that the servient consent holder is agreeing to turn off upon notice. So I have read that properly now. I guess the question still remains, should that be conditioned up as an entry condition? But we'll think about your responses. Mr. Enzel, you are free to go, right? And then we're just, I think, turning to your balance. If anyone's got any questions rising from the court's questions, nobody? Okay. And then turning to your balance, your questions, Mr. Moore. So we'll just let time for Mr. Enzel to slip away.
I just wanted to pick up on this issue over the transfer of the point of take, and it occurred to me whether we might be conflating two separate things into one application, and whether the correct way to think about the correct way to think about addressing this issue where the point of take has changed is that that may require a separate application to change the point of take. And following the mechanism under Section 136 of the Act, but that wouldn't necessarily get in the way of dealing with the replacement of a permit under the provisions recommended for Plan Change 7. So I'm just interested in whether perhaps I've understood that correctly. I'm looking at Ms. King in terms of how you process that type of application.
Yes, you have understood that correctly. It would be... It would probably be easier for the applicant to apply for a Section 136 separate to their application, as you said. Oh, sorry. I said it would be easier for an applicant to apply for a Section 136 separately to their application. I do agree with Mr. Enzor in terms of the risk potentially being low if it's the difference between the paper location and the actual on-the-ground location, because obviously that's been status quo for a while. My biggest concern is where someone applies to transfer a point of take and might remove them out of where their current priority position is, then disrupting the entire priority regime, for lack of a better word, within that stretch of the river.
So then when you're thinking about how you might process that application and you're following the prescribed process in Section 136, you'd be then turning your mind to the effects of the proposed transfer and the effect that might have on upsetting the apple cart, upsetting the regime in terms of access to water?
Yes, you would.
Now, turning back to the joint witness statement, there was a comment at paragraph 14, Mr. Wilson and Mr. Leslie noting or expressing a view that telemetry would be required to properly enforce the conditions. Now, I'll put that out there for you to answer if you're able to, but I'm interested to understand what the issue there was, or it may well be that's an issue that Mr. Cummings can usefully address when he's called.
Simon Wilson, it's just around the council's ability to monitor these things and have the information to check. So if we receive a complaint saying, I've issued a notice telling someone to cease, we need to have the information to see whether they've ceased or not. And the easiest way to do that is to look at their abstraction records. Mm-hmm. And the easiest way is to have those coming in on a daily basis. So have the information already in front of us.
Okay, no, I understand that. All right, I'm moving on now to the part of the statement that begins at paragraph 20. And here the three technical witnesses have expressed some of their concerns in relation to issues arising from carrying over the priorities, and I was interested to explore those a little if I might. Now, the first one I wanted to understand further was the point being made at paragraph 22, and there's reference to reducing the certainty of supply that they had under the deemed permit priority regime, and I just didn't quite understand the point that was being made there, so I wonder whether you could explain that a little further.
Alexandra King. So the point Mr. Wilson and I are explaining there is that if there is a deemed permit which did have priority, which has already been replaced, and that priority rank has been taken out of the system, then the lower rank now has less surety of supply because the dominant priority holder may prior had two consents to potentially ask to switch off. Now it's only got one, so the surety of supply for that one user might be less.
And that was the situation Mr. Wilson was describing a moment or two ago.
Correct.
Now, when you think about that situation, isn't the reality that that does reflect the status quo now if there is an RMA permit in the middle of the two?
Simon Wilson, I think it reflects the status quo today. Depends, I guess, where you draw that status quo line, and also, I guess, potentially the permit that has been renewed may still be a current deemed permit, which is just going to expire in 3 months, but there's priorities on it today that won't be there in 3 months.
Sorry, I didn't understand the last part of that.
So we have a number of current deemed permits that have already been replaced but not surrendered. So there are priorities on that current deemed permit, but the replacement's already been issued. So today there are priorities, but from the 2nd of October, there won't be a priority on the replacement consent.
And the council did that under the operative plan, under what policies?
there are policies referred to by Mr. Page, and I think Mr. DePaul's maker in his last response, which required you to have a look at the effect on other users.
Yes, so under that potential consent application, we would have assessed the effects on other users within that catchment under the operative regional plan and made a decision on to grant that consent based on that, so that consent may have extra conditions to look after supply to those other users.
We have covered the balance of the questions I had there, or the questions from the court have addressed the questions I had. I did want to finish by looking at the example draft conditions which are attached as Appendix 3. Now, I'm not sure who was holding the drafting pen or who I should direct these questions to, so the entire panel's feel free to answer. But just looking through the drafting there, the first question that arises in my mind, and I'm looking first at the dominant permit, and subparagraph A, that the consent holder may serve the subservient consent holder. The concept of service is a variable concept, and I'm interested to understand what precisely you had in mind when referring to the word serve in the context of this condition. What's the mechanism? How is the notice to be served to a subservient permit holder?
Alec Radra-King. I'm not actually sure if we had any specific way that the dominant would serve notice on the subservient. However, reading Mr. Cumming's evidence, it is quite clear that it may pay to be more specific in that wording there. I'm not sure if anyone else has got any further comment.
I think the wording as they are now, they open up a number of potential avenues to serve notice. Also referring to Mr. Cumming's evidence, there are pros and cons to different ones. For example, the email one is a very quick one, but there are some issues around email addresses and privacy. Then via mail is probably the more common one, but it implies a delay. So perhaps it is best to leave it open and look at it on a case-by-case basis, what is the best possible way or the most practicable way of serving the notice.
Might the issue be overcome by the subservient permit holder specifying in their application how they wish to be served?
Simon Wilson, I wouldn't have thought so, because consents can be transferred during their 6-year life, so there's no guarantee that what applies at the time of application applies for the life of the consent.
Might that issue be picked up when a notice of transfer is given, though, if you think about the mechanism for transferring a permit?
Simon Wilson, we'd certainly pick up that information at that point. I guess it still comes back to the privacy issue of the council sharing that information.
And the corollary perhaps to the service question, when reading the subservient consent holder condition, the phrase there is receipt of written notice from the dominant consent holder. Was that left intentionally broad to cover a range of modes of service, or was there something in particular that the group had in mind with those words?
Alexandra King. Again, I think it is helpfully broad, considering how broad the dominant is. However, again, reading Mr. Cummings' evidence, it would be helpful if the subservient were to sign off receipt notice or notice of receipt, so that if there were to be enforcement action, we were aware that the notice was actually received.
There might be some challenges with that by the recipient of a notice simply refusing to acknowledge service. So at a conceptual level, what I've heard is perhaps keeping it broad at this stage to enable a range of options to be relied upon, and I'm not sure whether I can go so far as to say there might be an opportunity to specify a mode of service on the part of the subservient consent holder as part of their application.
Alexandra King, it would potentially be helpful if council did include that in the application form, and then to let the dominant know the preferred mode of service with the subservient potentially providing contact details if that was the mode that they preferred.
Those are my questions. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Any other questions from council?
Just thinking about the transfer situation and thinking about the privacy issue, I'm wondering if that could be overcome by having something in the original application, perhaps, or the original affected party notice, however that's done, and then potentially something also on the transfer application, which basically provides a waiver of privacy for the new person that is taking the permit over to acknowledge that they understand that their contact details will be provided to the dominant permanent holder, and also providing that information about their preferred contact.
Alexandra King, I'm just unsure about the legality of that, because are you stepping into the Privacy Act?
Well,
no?
that's what I'm saying, is that you are asking that person to say that they understand that on a transfer to the new person, saying, because they're presumably also going to be signing the transfer application, to say that they understand that their details will be passed on, because it's in the existing permit anyway, the priority, or replication we'll call it, of the priority, and that their details will be passed on to the dominant holder to be able to contact them and what their preferred mode of service is.
Yeah, I'd be happy with that if that was an option.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner, do you have any questions on the balance? Any questions? And I have no questions, so no questions. Okay, so good. Where to from here? In terms of these provisions, I mean, like, do we wait and see what comes out of Mr. Cummings before going further, or is this things, you know, certainly sounds like some redrafting is required. What do you want to do?
I would have thought we might best proceed with Ms. King and Mr. Cummings, because there may be additional matters that come out that might then usefully be picked up if there's to be some further drafting. So I'd suggest we continue on and hear that evidence.
Okay, and then think about where to from after that. All right.
Yes.
Okie dokie. Right, well, thank you very much for your evidence. It's a huge effort, and as I said, even though cross-examination, and I know the court's questions at times can sound really picky, but the task, you know, the task that was sent you and how you've responded has been
really helpful in terms of highlighting perhaps a route we can go down. So it's all good. It's all good work. So thank you.
I thought we might move on to Mr. Cummings and give Ms. King a break for a wee while.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Cummings. Can you please confirm your full name for the record? Confirm it's Michael Anthony Cummings?
Yes, it is.
And you have prepared a statement of evidence dated 24 June 2021?
Yes, I have.
And in that statement of evidence, you confirm that you are the Senior Environmental Officer in the Compliance Monitoring Coastal Otago team at the Otago Regional Council?
Yes, I am.
And that you have 15 years' experience with issuing, monitoring and enforcement of resource consents, deemed permits and permitted activities in relation to the rights and obligations of the taking, conveyance and use of water, specifically in the Otago region.
Yes, I do.
And you've set out in paragraphs 4 through 5 the background experience that you have in this regard.
Yes, I have.
Are there any corrections that you wish to make to your statement of evidence?
Yes, I've got two corrections to make.
If you could just take us through those, please.
Certainly. My first correction is in paragraph 15, the second sentence. I would like to replace the word should with the word could. So the sentence reads, rather, the council could instead rely on its powers.
Thank you. And there was a second correction?
There is a second correction. On paragraph 111,
yes.
It's the very last sentence, and once again I'd like to replace the word should with could. So the sentence reads, rather, the council could simply rely.
Thank you. Subject to those corrections, do you confirm that the evidence in your written brief and the evidence that you're about to give is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes, it is.
If you could please remain for any questions from my friends and questions from the court.
Certainly.
Anyone got any questions?
Thanks, Your Honour.
You're for O'Regan right now?
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
Mr. Cummings, I really just want to clarify a couple of points you make in your evidence. Perhaps if we could start with the discussion around the need for the monitoring to be calibrated. So that you could understand whether or not people were continuing to take, whether it was a breach of the priorities and so on. Is that calibration really just requiring that to be consistent with what's required under the water monitoring regulations?
Are you asking in particular for the dominant consent holder, the subservient, or just in general?
Just in general.
Yes, this is the basis for which we make our decisions.
Yeah. And so in relation to consents for water permits, it's common, isn't it, for conditions to be imposed requiring compliance with the water monitoring regulations and ensuring calibration of the water monitoring equipment.
Yes, it is.
So in that sense, that's nothing new that would be required to help administer this regime, is it?
No, but there are requirements under the water measurement and reporting regulations that require that that there is to be telemetry. Under the 2020 regulation, under the regulations, the 2020 amendment actually specifies a particular time frame where they've actually got to provide that that telemetry. And in the most extreme cases, that's 2026.
So they'll have to continue to comply with those obligations regardless of this regime?
Well, they don't have to abide by the requirement to telemeter their water take until such stage as 2026.
Right. And if they don't have telemetry in currently, the alternative is to simply request a download of the monitoring information, isn't there?
That's right. And this information is generally held by a third party.
Yes, correct. In relation to just the contact information, when an applicant makes an application for a resource consent, one of the pieces of information that is required is an address for service, correct?
That is correct, yes.
And it's common these days for that to include email contact information?
I don't know. Unfortunately, I've been outside of the consenting team for quite some time. They do provide email addresses, but whether that's valid or useful as an address for service, I can't comment on. I'm sorry.
In your experience with enforcement, are there circumstances where resource consent holders are required to provide contact information for the likes of affected parties to register complaints? And I'm thinking things like landfills, for example, where there might be odour complaints, or mining activities where there might be issues around dust. And applicants will provide contact information publicly available so that people can contact them if there's an issue.
I'm not aware of any requirement under consent to do that.
Do you think there would be any reason why a consent condition couldn't require the provision of email or telephone contact information?
I can think, well, yes, that is possible as a requirement, as a consent condition, I believe, even though that's outside the scope of my expertise. What I would wonder, though, would be if we were actually requiring the transfer, because the activity has shifted, the transfer actually only refers to the holder rather than adjusting any of the conditions of the consent.
So you don't think it would be possible for that information to be kept up to date as part of the consent condition?
Yes, it is possible to keep that information up to date. Our records work. We work very hard with our records to make sure that they're up to date. There are circumstances where transfers, there are circumstances where some of the people responsible for the activities are not necessarily the consent holder, and that makes things a little more complicated.
Yes, but as the consent holder, you'd expect that they would have an obligation or at least pass on to the person that they employ, probably, to implement their consent if they had been issued with a notice of some description that would affect that person's role.
Yes, yes, that would be a reasonable expectation.
I have no further questions.
Okay. Anybody else?
Just a few matters, Your Honour. Mr. Cummings, I'm taking it that you are very much looking at enforcement from a prosecution perspective, potentially.
Looked at this from all possible avenues that we can undertake.
But the standard of evidence that you've indicated would be required would be sufficient to support a prosecution if it got to that point.
That's right.
And that's why, for example, in your view, it would be helpful if a dominant consent holder was to serve a notice on a subservient consent holder that they had a witness accompany them if they were doing that in person.
Yes.
And that's because you would see this as potentially heading towards a prosecution.
Yes, we always hope for the best, but
yeah,
prepare for the worst.
And it's certainly clear from the compliance plan that you've helpfully attached to your evidence, and that's Appendix 1, that the Council's approach is actually to take a number of steps and approaches to enforcement before we get to a prosecution, isn't it?
That's right, yes.
And so very much along the lines of talking to the potential problem consent holder in the first instance.
Yes.
And then you've talked about education and a whole series of steps before you would get to prosecution.
Yes.
And that would be something that a dominant permit holder would also be aware of, that you would, because you've told us you will, actually be looking to take a number of steps before you would be looking to prosecution.
That's right, yes.
And it might be that that person may then feel that for the first instance they don't necessarily need to strictly follow the or reach the standard of proof that might be required for a prosecution when they know that that's actually not what the council is going to do in the first instance, at least.
I don't know. I wouldn't want to put words into a dominant consent holder's mouth.
All right. Thank you. You've already talked with Ms. Irving about the telemetry issue, and that the alternative and the expectation of council is that where people don't currently have telemetry in place because they're not yet required to under the measuring and reporting of water takes regulations, that they would still be able to download and provide that information within 24 hours on request. Is that right?
I think 24 hours would be a bit of a reach. But they certainly would be able to provide that information if it was available, if their equipment was operating according as it should.
And, of course, if their equipment isn't operating, that would actually potentially provide a defence for you in any event.
That's right, yes.
You've made some comments on the draft condition, and I'm looking here at paragraph 71, and you've suggested, for example, the addition of the word upstream to the phrase subservient consent holder.
That's right, yes.
And that's simply to clarify that, obviously, if a subservient consent holder is downstream, it actually makes no difference.
That's right.
You also proposed that the dominant holder be able to exercise their right at any time. Having heard the discussion from the panel earlier today, do you agree that there are problems with that approach of a dominant consent holder being able to say at any time, no matter what the actual flow of water is, that, excuse me, Mr. Servient, subservient, sorry, holder that's 2 kilometres upstream of me, I'm telling you to turn off?
Yes, I agree with the panel. There are issues with that. When I thought of that and considered that, when I was thinking about that, it was taking one of the ingredients away, or one of the requirements that I'd have to prove if I was to actually take this to court.
Yes, and that was around the insufficient flows. That you're
right.
Concerned that the term insufficient flows is a bit loose.
That's right, yes.
However, part of the purpose of the replication, I'll use that term, of these conditions is to provide for the incidental environmental effect of these applying to maintain flows at the low flows. So actually the insufficient water or insufficient flow is a fundamental part of the priority regime, I'll call it that. Do you understand that?
I do understand that. However, that was outside the scope of what I was asked to prepare for.
All right. Thank you. I won't take matters any further. Thank you, Your Honour.
Can I just ask Ms Williams which paragraph you were referring to then? I just want to note up the response.
That's a good point, Your Honour. I sort of scribbled a whole heap of notes. And this is at paragraphs 101 on,
okay.
And in particular at paragraph 105, you do discuss there about there's full discretion to give notice, but it wouldn't be replicating the existing priority regime.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Your Honour. I have nothing further.
Re-examination. Have you got any questions, Commissioner?
Yes, I did have a couple of questions. Thank you. Afternoon. So I wanted to know how frequently the council uses the 329 water shortage direction. Perhaps you could give me a general sort of answer, and if I need any follow-up, I can follow up on it.
This hasn't been used. Sorry, I'll. This hasn't been used very often at all, in fact. It's just been put there as an option that we can consider. Unfortunately, the delegation for making a call under that section or a decision under that section is well above me, so I wouldn't know what the thresholds were or how to comment on that further. But I do know that it is an option that council does have.
And when you said it's not been often used, can you give me some kind of idea of when it has been used?
I know of once when it's been used.
So what year was that?
I couldn't comment on that. I can't recall that.
I presume that was during the irrigation
yes.
season, was it?
Yes, it was it was definitely over a summer, and it was a few years ago.
And so did it have to be renewed? Because I see you can only have it lasting...
For 14 days.
For 14 days,
yes.
And then you can keep renewing it. So how long did if you can remember...
I believe it was reviewed, renewed once, or extended once.
So that was for a month. And so what was it? A portion restricted or suspended, so presumably to the extent set out in the manner set out in the direction. So I presume there was quite a long list of things that people had to do.
My role with it was in regards to ensuring people were aware of it. It only had to be advertised in the paper, but we made sure that we contacted people and made sure that they were aware of the rule and that they were following the rule. They were still allowed to have water under certain circumstances, like for stock water or domestic use.
Right.
But beyond that, I couldn't comment on the technical aspects of that particular rule.
Right. But you didn't have to take any enforcement action?
No.
Other than perhaps reminding people about what the fact there was the order and they better follow it.
Yes.
So the other thing you suggested is that Section 17 of the RMA might be another mechanism that could be used. So how often would the Regional Council have used Section 17 with regard to water matters?
In regards to water matters, I don't know, sorry.
Wrote that, what were you, hypothetical possibilities were you thinking of?
The examples that I'm thinking of where issues like Section 17 have been used have been involved with discharges. So discharges into the environment. I know that they've been used. I'm not sure what for the exact details of what they've been used for.
Discharges?
Yes. Yeah.
But you're not aware of
aware any of it being used for
quantity of tanks and that sort of thing. So going back to my original question, so what do you think might be a hypothetical possibility in terms of the takes and the use of water?
This example, it could be used as the example I've written is in regards to using an abatement notice to request people to cease taking water. The abatement notice is set for a particular a period of time with particular restrictions on it, and provided the recipient of the abatement notice abides by those rules, there's no further enforcement action.
Thank you.
Cool. No, thank you.
Just thinking about that. If you think that what the planning team has come up with is problematic, why does Section 17 make it any easier? In fact, it's probably harder because, you know, nobody's giving you written notice or anything else.
The challenges that I have with what was proposed by the joint witness statement are involved regarding whether it was whether the dominant shareholder consent holder was entitled to, and whether the subservient consent holder actually received the information.
But how does Section 17 overcome those two evidential gaps or evidential issues?
It overcomes that in the same way that the council's minimum flows and requirements under that. If we've got control over how information, how the notice to cease taking water is given, makes my job an awful lot easier when it comes to challenging someone that might not have adhered to that instruction to cease.
So, so you think your two problems are A, whether notice is received.
That's right.
Is received. Okay, so it's a factual issue. And then the second is whether or not the dominant consent holder is entitled to exercise.
That is right.
The right?
Yes.
Okay. So you think Section 17 bridges the gap on the factual matter where the notice is received, bridges that gap or addresses that gap. How? Because you would still need a dominant consent holder telling a subservient consent holder to, in this case, we've been told to cease. And there would need to be evidence of notice being given, at least. And if not, notice being received or inferred notice being received due to the method of service. So it's the same issue either way.
Sorry,
so how do you step across it?
I realise now what the disconnect is.
Mm.
The Section 17 would be considered if council was aware of in-stream values that were being at risk because of somebody's activities.
Mm.
Now. And going
outside. Yeah, okay. So it's in-stream values. It's not actually abstractors behaving in a way which ensures that the flow in the river is available to be taken.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Well, maybe the disconnect there then is that, as I understand it, the right of priority in the past or currently sets up a flow sharing regime, for want of a better word. And that is for the benefit of abstractors, and it might have an incidental benefit to the environment, as it turns out, but it's for the benefit of abstractors. So that's its primary focus. And that indeed is what is proposed to be its continued primary focus, abstractors being part of the environment.
Yes.
It's only a side benefit that galaxids might continue to survive or subsist under this regime, but nevertheless, that's how it's, that is how it's been promoted.
Yes.
So you would use Section 17 duty to look after galaxids, not abstractors.
That's right, yes.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. That's helpful. Any questions?
I think there's my own question, really, is you set out here a process that could be followed. If one priority holder seeks certain notice on another. Has this ever happened in the past, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge.
So this would be whole new territory.
That's right, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Thank you,
Ron. Okay. Anything arising from the court's questions?
Thank you, Your Honour.
Right, great. Thank you very much for your evidence, Mr. Cummins. It looked like a very late night served, or it could have been a late night for Ms. Melhock, not sure. But we got it on the day. That was like a minute before midnight. So thank you very much. Big effort. Right, thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I now, are you happy to continue on? Yes, I now call Ms. King. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You confirm your full name is Alexandra Lucy King?
Yes.
And you are the team leader consents Coastal Otago at the Otago Regional Council?
Yes.
And you have prepared a further brief of evidence dated 24 June 2021?
Yes.
And within that brief of evidence you've set out your qualifications and experience, paragraphs 3 through to 6?
Yes.
Are there any questions you wish to make to your statement?
No.
Do you confirm that to your statement of evidence and the evidence you're about to give is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
If you could please remain for any questions from my friend and questions from the court.
Thank you. Who's got questions?
Yes, just a few. I just want to clarify, at your paragraph 13 in your brief of evidence, you record your opinion that was recorded in the joint witness statement, that the more efficient and effective option is for the rights of priorities to cease on 1 October. Is that it? In that there's just nothing that regulates, I suppose, the relationship between water users, or did you have an alternative method or regime in mind?
I did turn my mind to this, and I did try to be as helpful as possible if priorities were transferred in terms of providing those potential consent conditions and things. I did not come up with a new idea, unfortunately.
I was going to ask you if you had what it was. Perhaps just want to talk to you about the Pigburn example that you worked through in your evidence. And I think you expressed some concern around the complexity of taking or re-implementing a priority regime based on the application that's been filed for the Pigburn catchment. And you highlight in your paragraph 38, B, Romans 1 through to 5, sort of changes or components of the Pigburn application that sort of add a layer of complexity to implementing the priority regime. Is it your understanding that in that application there was a suite of residual flows and so on that accompanied that reconfiguration of the regime on that water body?
Yes.
And did you make any inquiries about whether or not the Pigburn water users would continue to pursue that reconfiguration if Plan Change 7 and the controlled activity pathway associated with it was to become operative?
No, I based this test on the application in front of me.
I just want to, I suppose, ask you some of the same sorts of questions that I just worked through with Mr. Cummings in relation to your paragraph 47 in terms of issues around how notice might be given, confirmation of notice received and so on. Do you see there being any barriers to resource consent conditions that require provision of an email or contact phone number for the purposes of the notice requirements?
Yes, so when you asked this question, I did turn my mind to it for a couple of minutes. And I understand Mr. Cummings' concerns if it was to be transferred to a new holder, that there potentially might need to be a variation to a consent condition. I did come up with an option that it could be a contact management plan or similar, where the consent holder needs to keep that updated and therefore the consent condition would not need to be varied.
That's my next question. That's what I had in mind too. I have no further questions, Your Honour.
Thank you, Ms. Williams.
Thank you, Your Honour. And thank you, Ms. King, because that has very helpfully also addressed one of the questions that I was going to ask. And so would you, just on the same issue of a contact management, what have I written down, contact management plan condition, would that mean that, for example, if you have a change in personnel managing the undertaking of the activities, the consent holder remains the same, but, you know, people move on, and so you've got a new manager, in effect, who's managing the activity, managing the operation of the consent, and you would see that also being able to be captured by something like a contact management plan?
Yes, I think it would. It would potentially follow along the similar lines to other management plans we have, that we ask the consent holder to keep it updated,
yep,
and either provide it to the consent authority annually or upon request. And so if any of those changes are within there, then council has got the ability to get a hold of them.
Would you impose on the consent holder a positive obligation to advise of any change?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so that would address the change in personnel, and obviously on a transfer, as discussed before, again, that would also capture the ability to, by having a positive obligation, that would also capture the transfer to a new holder of the take at the same point of take.
Yes.
You've also, sorry, I'm just going to go to something completely different now, and I just have to find my notes. I actually now want to go back to policy 10A.2.1, and this you discuss at paragraphs 27 and 28 of your evidence. And in particular, this is where we have the reference to the 18 March 2020 date, which there was some discussion with the planners on the panel this morning, but I don't recall you being actually asked about that date. And so I just wanted to explore with you your reasoning at para 28, where you consider that that would be sufficient and appropriate with a minor amendment.
Yes, I did have time to consider the questions Mr. Moore put to the panel this morning,
yeah,
and he made quite a good point in terms of, and I think I did comment on the fact that it would almost mean an assessment of the effect of the priority regime at that date.
Yes.
Yeah.
And is that a concern for you, that you would, it would essentially lock in place something then which may not actually be in effect as of now?
It is a concern that that is a route that potentially you would need to assess. I don't think I can comment on whether it would be the same now versus,
yep,
the 18th of March.
And certainly from your perspective, you actually, if the purpose of Plan Change 7 is to be largely a transactional plan change for it, because it's a transitional plan change, you would not want to have to go and assess the effect of priorities. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. I just wanted to also explore with you, I guess, a little the possibility that again was discussed with the joint panel around having either an entry condition or something in the application which requires essentially the the linking permit holders to consent to each other's permits, if I put it that way. You know what I'm talking about. And would that perhaps get across some of your concerns, again, as expressed in your evidence, around not actually having all the information to put all the priorities into the permit?
Yes, I think it may, in terms of, are you saying that then applicants would nearly be all applying at the same time for that specific catchment?
I'm not sure that they'd necessarily be applying at the same time, but because each applicant, as an entry condition, has also got to obtain the approval and basically buy in of particularly the subservient permits, that potentially picks up on some of your concerns about things getting missed.
I think it may. The reason I say may is because we would be working under the assumption that everyone got everyone that was necessary.
Yep.
And I am aware that there are some catchments, which I think Mr. De Palsemaker discussed, that link to water bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And I just need to make sure that everyone involved had given written approval for the entry condition.
As part of the application, would they be required to provide a copy of the existing permit? I'll call it a permit.
Yes.
And that will have described in some way the existing rights of priority on it,
yes,
won't it?
Yes.
So that it certainly gives you that starting point to check, and you would then be following up on if there was someone that is listed there that is not then providing that approved party as part of the application?
Yes.
And that would then enable you to identify perhaps where people were no longer operating and had essentially surrendered takes?
Do you mean no longer operating priorities or no longer operating deemed permits?
No longer operating the deemed permit.
Yes, it may, but then that also brings me back to my point of it potentially disrupting the entire priority regime if someone has surrendered or is no longer going to apply for that permit. So it would alleviate concerns regarding who would be involved in that priority system, but I would still then have a concern about the priority regime being disrupted if a user had surrendered.
So what you would actually perhaps also want as part of the application would be a statement from someone who has surrendered a permit to just confirm that they have surrendered the permit or are no longer operating under that permit.
Yes, but I would still have the problem of the regime being upset if that person had surrendered.
But actually, if they've already surrendered, then it would continue the regime as it is now.
That is under the assumption that they hadn't been utilising that previously.
That does make that assumption, yes. But okay. All right, I think I've probably taken that about as far as I can, Your Honour. I'll leave it there.
Ms. Williams, my friend, put a question to you in relation to whether requiring written approvals might provide a further backstop, my words, not hers, to ensure that you'd identified all of the relevant permits. When you think about that proposition, doesn't simply identifying the permits in the application achieve the same outcome? Because if a permit's not identified in the application, the applicant wouldn't know to go and get a written approval from somebody. So it doesn't actually take matters any further.
No, I agree.
Thank you. No further questions?
Right. 2 points of clarification. So you were talking about, and I'm not quite sure that I quite get it yet, we've got deemed permits which are linking two water bodies.
Yes.
Can you talk me through what the issue is there?
So I can think of the low burn where it also links to the royal, not royal burn, Roaring
Hitchment. Yep.
It just brings up complexities in terms of how that priority then sits within the Roaring Meg catchment.
Now, just to slow down a little bit, yep. So Lowburn, I'm familiar with that catchment, but are you saying that water is taken out of Lowburn catchment and put into the Roaring Meg catchment, or is something else happening?
No, so one permit holder holds... So there's two permits that I can think of,
yeah,
that link the Roaring Meg and the Lowburn.
Yeah.
And they both have priorities within those catchments, so it's just...
How does that actually happen? Like, if I was to grab their deemed permit, what would it say, roughly?
We're testing my knowledge of touch. But it would have the priority ranking for both catchments within...
Within the same permit?
No, I think they would be separate.
Yeah.
Or, no, actually, I can't answer that, I'm sorry.
Because I couldn't see, but then it's probably my lack of imagination or, you know, or just haven't seen enough of these deemed permits because I've only seen what Mr. Moore gave me. But I just didn't know why it was a problem if you're taking water, say, from the Lowburn catchment and it's discharged into the Roaring Meg catchment, why that caused a problem for deemed permits. Just say the deemed permit pertains to, you know, the Lowburn, well, people just continue to take in accordance with their rights, you know, their subservient or dominant rights.
Yes, I do see your point. I think maybe the point I was trying to convey, and maybe I didn't quite do it properly, was it just creates another level of complexity in terms of... The application I was looking at was one permit holder who held shares in both a Lowburn and Roaring Meg catchment and were applying to merge them into one RMA permit.
Uh-huh. And then I think that could be complex, not sure how they're doing that, but that doesn't matter because that was the question that I put to the panel was... do you anticipate people substantially amending their applications to take advantage of the controlled activity rule or the RDA rule? And the answer was yes. They're going to have to be going under, you know, the existing regime, if I could put it that way, and not doing these merging or divvying ups or whatever has been proposed and understandably has been proposed in response to the operative plan and this notified plan. So I guess the question is that a problem? Yes. Is that a problem for this plan change as now recommended by the planners and, you know, and together with the priorities mechanism, or is that a problem which you see arising if people insist on their application for resource consent, which, if that's what they're doing, it sounds like a non-complying activity, but I might be wrong.
Yes, I think I'm unable to comment on what applicants may or may not do. I am aware that a lot of them will amend to come in line with PC7. However, I do think that there would be a number that maybe would try and go down the non-compliant pathway for a variety of reasons, one being that they've been in the system for a substantial amount of time.
Is that because they're fed up? Or is that because... what does being in the system...
Although,
why does that necessitate a different outcome? Now, that from their point of view, it might, because, they've invested a lot of money in this, and I get that.
Yes, so that would be the basis of my reasoning there, that they have applied for an application some time ago and invested a lot of money in the application as it currently stands.
Okay. Do you think you need to come back tomorrow or check overnight the Lowburn Roaring Meg application to see whether there is some complexity on the existing deemed permit or whether your thinking, in fact, reflects the applicant's own desire to merge into one resource consent takes from two different catchments? Yeah,
I can confirm that with you.
Yeah, confirm that one way or the other. Be really keen to know the answer to that. And then the second question. It's dealing with the surrendering of the permit, and that could be problematic because the regime is upset. And is the concern there that, say, you've got five deed permits on a single water body and number three is surrendered in total, so it no longer exists. So to number one and number two, under this scenario, are downstream, so it's the easy scenario. So instead of being able to call upon three permits to reduce or cease, they can only call upon two, and that's problematic.
Yes, I think the basis would be that the surrendered permit had been used previously.
Had been used?
Yes.
So if it's surrendered, then that water remains in the system.
Yes.
Yes. And so in that sense, it's not really problematic at all because number three is no longer in the system. The water remains in the system and number three has gone somewhere else, whoever the permit holder was. And so then one and two are rightfully looking at four and five to cease when flows start to recede.
Yes, and so in terms of flow availability for the one and two, it would probably be a positive. But if we are also looking at any environmental gains with holding the priority system, that may also be disrupted.
So it's not a lot you can do about that. If somebody doesn't want to renew their water permit.
No, we can't force anyone.
No, we can't force anyone to renew their water permit.
No.
So that's nothing. I can't see how I can handle that. That's
no. And I, where I could try to come up with some way of handling it within the priority regime if we were to move it forward, it was just a thought I had that I thought I should put down but didn't also have any way of adding that in.
What was your thought? Sorry.
So I knew that it was a concern I had, so I noted it down, but I didn't have any way of rectifying it within the plan change.
No. Okay. But that could be entirely hypothetical. That the there's a hypothetical existing deem permit holder who does not wish to renew their consent, who doesn't wish to apply for replacement consent and does not, and that water remains within the system.
Yes, I think where the concern became apparent for me was looking at the Pigburn example, where the third priority was shifting to the fourth priority location but surrendering their previous consent.
Now, if you're going to do that, don't you need a 136?
Yes.
Yes. And then isn't that the time to have a look at, well, what are the implications?
Yes.
Yeah. Have I missed something in thinking it's a 136 if you're going to shift your take down to... Yeah, if I missed something in that, is it as simple as that?
Within the application under my paragraph 38B1, I can turn you it says this application does not seek to replace the take for third priority at that point. So yes, I think it would be a 136 matter as you have just said.
All right. Well,
so 136 was dealt with all non-modified, not requiring any written approval from things?
I haven't processed any that have required any written approvals.
So they're all dealt with non-modified, are they?
The ones I have dealt with have been. I can't say whether they all have, unfortunately.
Why do you deal with them all non-notified? Is there a rule in the plan that allows for that?
The ones that I have assessed that there weren't any affected parties to the move of point of obstruction.
And so other people, well, other priority people you assessed weren't affected, or weren't you worrying about the priority question?
The ones that I have processed were on the Pomahaka, and they were within, there were no permits between the take move location, if that makes sense. So it just moved 100 metres downstream, and there were no other users within that 100 metre stretch.
What the planners have proposed in the JWS is not a vehicle to allow the consenting team to come in and have regard to the effect on the environment as a consequence of anything that the non-human environment, so the galactic environment in particular. So it's not a vehicle for that. That might be, again, the benefit of it, but it's not the vehicle to allow you to come in and do that.
No, I agree.
Yeah. And so if there is a Section 136 application, though, I think what you're saying, because somebody wants to move their point of take, you'd be looking at the wider sense of environment, both human as well as creature and stream environment.
From my understanding, yes.
Mm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything arising? Oh, sorry. Yeah, now you go.
I did ask earlier about the effect of having an RMA permit sort of interposed in all of this. But I guess I'd just like to think about it slightly differently now. With an RMA permit right at the bottom of a tributary or something, somebody's got in and they've done that and they've been thinking, oh well, the whole deemed permit thing's going to go and people are going to have to come and get new consents all the way up this tributary. But if the priority system is retained, those people that have the RMA permit, they've been working on potentially a false premise. Would that be right?
In terms of the thinking that the priorities would be gone by?
The 1st of October or thereabouts, and there would be a set of consents upstream of them, RMA permits.
Yes.
Regulating what to happen higher up in the catchment.
So I'm not quite sure if I understand the question. Do you mind rephrasing?
Well, if you've got a tributary and you've got an RMA permit that somebody's got at the bottom and they've gone off and they might have got their DEM permit replaced as an RMA permit, and they would have been thinking, oh well, we've got our RMA permit, so we know what the regime is in terms of what we can take, but everything upstream of us is in a bit of a state of flux because what's gone on with the priorities. In the past, people are going to have to come along and get their RMA permits.
Yes, that
because the deemed permits are going to fall away.
Yes, there is a possibility that may have occurred, that everyone was under the assumption that priorities were ceasing to exist in October 2021.
So might it be possible that some of the, you know, person in this position may end up in a disadvantaged position from where they thought they might?
Yes, it is a possibility.
In terms of investments they've made, for example?
It is a possibility. I think it would possibly be dependent on their priority rank. So if they were a lower priority rank, for example, the Pigburn, the lowest in the catchments, the lowest priority rank. So no one was able to call on them anyway. So it would kind of depend on a case-by-case basis whether that has any effect on their RMA consent.
So what you're saying is they didn't have any leverage to begin with because they didn't really have any priority.
Yes. Whereas if that was the first priority right at the bottom of the catchment and they had a lot of leverage, then I think that maybe they would be at a disadvantage.
Right, okay, thank you. That's where I was right. To get to. Thank you.
Any further questions, Councillor?
Yeah, just to round out the section 136 transfer question, is your understanding that there's a very wide list of matters that can be taken into account when assessing a transfer application?
Yes.
And as I read that, the consent authority shall have regard, in addition to section 104, to the effects of the proposed transfer, including the effect of ceasing or changing the exercise of the permit under its current conditions, and the effects of allowing the transfer. So when you hear that description, and it's out of section 136, subsection 4, that would give you the broad range of matters that you might need to consider when looking at a transfer, perhaps moving further downstream from an intervening consent holder's abstraction point.
Yes.
Thank you. No further questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your participation. Thank you. Okay. So running a little bit behind, but no doubt we'll catch up tomorrow.
That sounds suitably optimistic.
I am optimistic. No, I am, actually. I'm sure we'll get there.
I do wonder, in relation to the... Well, there's two things going on. We've got next the legal submissions on priorities.
Mm.
Now, those submissions have all been pre-filed, and I wonder whether there may be some efficiencies gained if Council were to give a summary of their submissions rather than reading right through their submissions in the court's hands on that.
Okay. You could, perhaps with a particular focus on 124, because that's where you all disagree with Dr. Somerville, who disagrees back, and he's actually filed his submission, so that should be available, hopefully, on the website, or hopefully shortly anyway.
Oh, that might be helpful to perhaps see that in advance.
So, Dahlia, can you also send that to the lawyers as well? Upload it? Thanks. Yep.
Okay.
That's where the focus should come, I think, because I don't think you take any issue with the... There were three issues...
Creature of statute,
everyone agrees. And the third issue, which I've utterly forgotten.
Which was the can you have a plan that has a rule that has the effect of priorities?
Yes. And so that's under consideration. Yeah.
Yes. So it's really the second.
Yeah, it's really the second. Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll...
Bearing in mind, Dr. Somerville's also to come back on the virus of what's been proposed as well, which is... he's going to be doing that not this week but next Monday, given his other commitments.
Yes.
And that's also why, you know, if there's going to be changes, it would be good that he see it, not just work his way through an old copy.
Mm. Yes. Now, on that point, we had prepared some written submissions addressing the VIRAS point.
Mm.
I know I was intending to deliver those immediately following the Section 124 submissions, if that was the right time to deal with that. And my understanding is my friends have prepared perhaps a summary of the points that they wish to make in that regard. So we'll deal with both of those.
No, William's shaking.
Oh, no.
He's doing that tonight.
Oh, sorry, Your Honour. Something I was going to address it orally only, and I wasn't sure quite what my friends were doing.
Right. Okay. Oh,
we'll take it as it comes, but again, it's important that it does come in so that Dr. Somerville can have regard to that. So not only have regard to the submissions, but I think ideally have regard to the drafting as well. Does it overcome any, you know, because the question of RAs exists regardless of the date, you know, the drop-dead date, is it 1 October or is it later? Mm. The issue arises. One way or t'other, I think we're all agreed you're grappling with the issue. Mm.
Yes. So we'll deal with that perhaps first in the morning.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just flagging that because I appreciate we've got some witness availability challenges perhaps brewing tomorrow with respect to the impanelling of the planners collectively with respect to the objective.
Mm.
I wonder whether Ms. Jackson can update the court as to constraints.
So everybody was thinking about a time, so I'm in your hands.
I was just going to say, Your Honour, that Mr. Brass isn't on the flight tomorrow morning that he was expecting to be on. He's been moved to an afternoon flight. He's not okay. He's here, still here.
So he's going to be here tomorrow morning.
So he can be here tomorrow morning. He would have to be away by, I think, 2:30 tomorrow afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
So just in terms of timing, just so that you're aware of that, Your Honour.
I wonder whether we might start with the impanelling of those witnesses and then follow that with the submissions on priorities.
It would be better if everybody's happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So in terms of Mr. Hodgkins and Mr. Twos and Mr. Enzor, are they actually, though, available in the morning? Be there. Okay, and everyone's still happy with the 9:30? Start? Yep.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so be there at 9:30 and we'll crack on with the empanelment. And Ms. Perkins, I haven't heard anything from Ms. Perkins. AVL? Okay. So who we got with AVL? We've got... Sorry, Ms. Perkins by AVL, Mr. Enzor. Mr. De Pelsmaker?
Yeah,
I should not have let him go. No. Okay. Well, and Mr. De Pelsmaker, that's fine. Yeah. And maybe Mr. Hodgkins, his lawyers say he's unavailable, but don't say what he's unavailable doing, so we've asked for clarification. And hopefully we'll know one way or the other. Okay. And Mr. Brass, is he around? Going to be around? He's around. Okay. In person. All right. Very good. And... in terms of testing the AVL, how are we set for that? Good. All right. Very good. All right. Well, we'll crack on at 9:30 with the joint witness statement. The first focus is on the objective before we, and then we can release some witnesses, hopefully. Thank you very much. All rise.